This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week, we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C.
This means, I believe, we need a president who understands that just as Islam represents the greatest long-range threat to our liberty, so the homosexual agenda represents the greatest immediate threat to every freedom and right that is enshrined in the First Amendment.
We should remember that decency and civility are values, too. One of the speakers who will follow me today has crossed that line, I think. Poisonous language doesn't advance our cause.
But the reason, as a pastor, that I'm excited about the candidacy of Rick Perry is not because of his fiscal policies, but it's because of his strong commitment to biblical values.
I think it's unfortunate that Ron Paul's campaign does this to the straw polls. They bring their folks in, and I wouldn't write that campaign off simply because they game straw polls.
Although it's now been a full week since the event, the gathering that's called the Values Voters Summit continues to make news, why even overshadowing the latest GOP presidential debate that came on Tuesday. At the same time, the movement now coalescing under the banner The Other 99% continues to grow and expand. Now, we touched on both of these topics in our news roundup on last weekend's show, but Religion Dispatch's senior editor Sarah Posner has been writing up a storm on the summit and its aftermath, as well as offering insightful analysis of the protests on America's streets. Sarah will join us in the studio on this edition of State of Belief Radio. I can't wait.
The bipartisan commission says Egypt's Coptic Christians and other religious minorities face severe repression. In addition to citing countries of particular concern regarding freedom of worship, the commission named 10 nations on a watch list for religious liberty violations.
What is the role of the United States in helping to protect religious freedom in the world? The current mechanism is at risk of shutting down due to lack of funding next month. But is the mechanism itself even up to the task at hand? I've got some thoughts on the U.S. International Religious Freedom Commission that I want to share with you later in the show. But first,
the scripture nowhere condemns same-sex relationships that are loving and committed.
Reverend Jimmy Creech, a Methodist minister from Omaha, Nebraska, who was put on church trial after blessing the relationship of two women.
Gay and lesbian rights have been in the headlines this year, both in the ongoing culture wars and within several Christian denominations. You know that flashpoint issues have included marriage equality and the ordination of LGBT persons. But of course, none of that is new. October 6th marked the 43rd anniversary of the founding of the Universal Fellowship of Metropolitan Community Churches when Reverend Troy Perry answered the call to create a place for LGBT Christians to worship and feel loved and accepted just as they are. And in 1999, the Reverend Elder Jimmy Creech was defrocked by the United Methodist Church for presiding over the holy union of two women in North Carolina. He'd already faced possible punishment for serving as a celebrant at a same-gender covenant ceremony 2 years earlier. Ordained in 1970, Reverend Creech was and is an outspoken advocate and activist supporting churches' acceptance of LGBT persons. Today, As co-founder of the organization Faith in America, he travels widely and continues to be a leading voice on this issue. Reverend Creech has received more honors and awards than we could ever name here on this show and still have time to interview him. He is the author of the new book, Adam's Gift, about his experiences of the church's struggle to welcome and accept lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender persons. Let me be right up front with you and say that this is a man I've known for years, loved for years, and appreciate. And I'm so very pleased to welcome Jimmy Creech to State of Belief Radio today. Welcome, Jimmy.
Thank you, Weldon. You're very gracious. It's wonderful to be with you.
I know you're speaking to us by phone from Nebraska, and we're going to talk about the events in which you've been participating this week. But I want to start with some history. I think it's fair to say you've come to be a legend in the battle to include sexual minorities in the church. How did that start? What moved you to make this such a central part of your ministry?
Well, it was not something I intended. It was not a goal in any sense of the word. I understand myself to be a pastor and love being a pastor. And I was serving a congregation in eastern North Carolina, a small town, in 1984, loving my work as a pastor of that congregation, when a member of the congregation came out to me as a gay man. He was the first person who ever self-identified to be as a gay person.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked to me about his experience, both in the church and in society at large, and told me things I was completely naive about, things I did not know, things that really upset me quite a bit. I'd known him. I call him Adam. He is the person whose name I give to my book, Adam's Gift. His mm-hmm. gift to me was telling me his story.
Mm-hmm.
I'd known him for 3 years. He was a leader in the community, a leader in the church, someone I admired, respected greatly. He was a faithful Christian, gentle, kind person.
Mm-hmm.
It not only changed my thinking about gay people, but it changed my thinking about the role the church plays in the persecution of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. It helped me begin to understand that persecution.
The subtitle for your book is A Memoir of a Pastor's Calling to Defy the Church's Persecution of Lesbians and Gays. We're talking to a guy who was not an activist in the LGBT community, but a pastor who saw a wrong and tried to right it. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that is very correct.
How do you feel about the progress that's been made, and I guess how much farther do we have to go?
Well, I begin by first of all acknowledging there's a long way for us to go still. But when I look back over the last 24 years since I became active in 1987, on the grand scale, you know, we have had major changes take place in the Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Lutheran Church. Polling now indicates that 74% of Roman Catholics support either marriage or civil unions for same-gender couples. They support adoption rights for same-gender couples, employment protection for same-gender people, loving people. We've repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There is very serious discussion with a possibility of actually repealing the Defense of Marriage Act.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot that has been done. There's also been reaction. Many of the states, most I think 31 of the states now have a constitutional amendment defining marriages between one man and one woman. There is still a lot of religious bigotry, language that is very hurtful and harmful that's being spoken from national leaders in the religious community.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot that still needs to be done.
Jimmy, I, several years ago, after a bout with depression, wrote a book on depression, And I know out of that experience that the book writing does something for readers, but it also does something to the author. Your book, Adam's Gift, A Memoir of a Pastor's Calling to Defy the Church's Persecution of Lesbian and Gays, is a massive memoir of sensitivity. What did it do to you to revisit all of that?
It was very painful. A lot of what I tell is about the pain I've seen others experience, mm-hmm. other lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people and their families experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's also about my own losses, and it's not intended to be a sort of self-pity kind of thing. But that was the reality. That's the story. And getting back in touch with the events and the consequences of those events, and being able to tell the story truthfully and candidly, required immersing myself once again in the pain of mm-hmm. those moments.
Your writing and work are both informed with a moral and spiritual clarity that is precious and, I'm sad to say, rare. Where does that come from for you?
I laugh. I'm asked that question often, and I know it sounds simplistic, but I have to say that it really comes from what I learned in church as a child and as a youth.
Yeah.
I recall in our Methodist Youth Fellowship meetings, every Sunday night before we left, we would sing, "Are You Able, Said the Master, mm-hmm. to be crucified with me?" And you can't sing that over and over again that much and without it doing something to you.
Right.
It was the stories of Jesus. It was the stories of compassion, love your neighbor, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Those teachings shaped my life mm-hmm. and shaped who I understand myself to be and what I believe God calls us to do, and that is to make the world a better place, to bring God into the world, and that means bringing justice and love and compassion into the world in which we live.
See, in our church, we sang Jesus loves the little children of the world, all the little children of the world, and I thought they meant it.
Yeah.
But as you found out, as I found out, there is some gap between the music and the realities on the ground.
Yeah, and the marvelous thing is the teaching survived the realities. I had that same experience. It was when I was in my last 2 years of high school that the civil rights movement really opened up in this country. And I began to see the people who taught me the stories of Jesus, who told me that, you know, loving your neighbor is what God wants us to do and that our role is to make the world a better place. I saw those same people angry and acting with hatred toward people of color.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up in a very rigidly segregated society, and I was told it was God's will that the races be segregated, that Black people were morally inferior to white people. It was a, you know, white mm-hmm. supremacist point of view.
Yeah.
Those were the same people who told me these wonderful stories, biblical stories.
Right.
And the story survived the bigotry, and it was the story that shaped me, not the bigotry.
Right.
And so I'm grateful even to those who were so angry with the Black people for wanting their and equal rights in the mm-hmm. society. I'm grateful that they were able to teach me those stories because I still hold on to them.
We've got to take a short break, but there's a lot more to come with Reverend Jimmy Creech, so please stay tuned. I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is Reverend Jimmy Creech, a hero for the cause of LGBT equality in the church, author of a fine new book called Adam's Gift. Jimmy, let's talk about what brings you back to Nebraska this week. You've spoken at a number of events this past week, and I'm fascinated with the event that took place this past Tuesday when you were observing National Coming Out Day on the lawn of your former church in Omaha, First United Methodist Church. There's something profoundly biblical about the fact that, one, you were not able to enter the sanctuary, and two, that the event had to be identified as an interfaith celebration for you, as I understand it, to be permitted to take part. Tell us what it's like to return to Omaha under these circumstances.
Well, first of all, I was warmly welcomed by those who invited me to come. Very gracious welcome. It was an ecumenical or actually an interreligious event for National Coming Out Day that was sponsored by the Heartland Clergy for Inclusion. What this was about was what is being done now in the future, the vision they have of being fully inclusive. And I was able to be here and to share in that and to speak a word of encouragement.
Jimmy, when you were standing there on that lawn, what was going on inside?
First of all, I felt like I was back home again.
Huh.
I was with family. This congregation is not like just another congregation I've served. We went through a tremendous amount together, even in a very short period of 2 years. And they are a gracious, wonderful, courageous congregation. I was also thrilled to know that so much progress has been made since the bishop would not allow me to stay and I had to leave in 1998. I grieve that I was not able to remain with them on their journey, but I am very grateful and proud of the witness that the congregation continues to make.
What have you done with anger? Especially anger about the church?
I have been angry. I have felt hurt. But those have not been feelings that have endured very long. What I have lost, I've lost because of what I've done. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people have lost things because of who they are. That's a much more profound hurt.
Do you have a favorite moment or memory from all of your years of activism and the challenges that you've faced and overcome during these years?
A really positive one that comes to my mind is that when I was working with the North Carolina Council of Churches, we voted into membership the Metropolitan Community Church. We were the first state ecumenical body to vote into membership. The Metropolitan Community Church. You know, the MCC has been trying to be a member of the National Council for 20 years or more, and it has been denied. And it was denied in other places, other states, but we were the first. The motion to approve the membership application from the MCC was made by a Roman Catholic priest, and it was overwhelmingly supported.
Oh, that's
that was a great moment.
Reverend Jimmy Creech, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio. The book that you've written, Adam's Gift, A Memoir of a Pastor's Calling to Defy the Church's Persecution of Lesbians and Gays, is a marvelous contribution to this whole thought and history. Jimmy, thanks for being here.
Well, then it was my pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Coming up right after this break, Religion Dispatch's senior editor Sarah Posner will join us in the studio to rehash the Values Voters Summit last weekend and discuss the other 99%. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. This free State of Belief Radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S. drawn from 75 different faith traditions, we're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. Now look, the Values Voters Summit is an annual event sponsored by enormous, well-funded, ultra-conservative, religion-driven organizations. The summit draws a remarkably partisan set of political candidates to make their case to the evangelical base. This year, there were some newsworthy events at the summit, some sideshow moments that received a large percentage of media coverage. And to help us sort one from the other, I'm joined now by one of our favorite guests, Sarah Posner, senior editor at Religion Dispatches magazine. Sarah, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me again.
Now, maybe I should start with asking you to highlight some of what you found most noteworthy and why this particular event even deserves our attention.
Right. Well, what was really notable this year, and I've attended and covered every Values Voters Summit since they started, was how there was a lack of unity. In fact, possibly you could characterize it as them eating their own at this Values Voter Summit. And all of that centered around attacks on Mitt Romney's Mormonism from evangelicals, including a pastor who endorsed and introduced Rick Perry and the notorious radio host Brian Fisher, who is employed by the American Family Association, which is not only a co-sponsor of the Values Voters Summit, but was also the chief bankroller and one of the main organizers of Perry's prayer event in Houston in August. So it really set itself up as a people behind Perry are going after Mitt Romney's Mormonism.
Is the divisiveness more pronounced than in the past when there were competing candidates?
Yes. I covered the Values Voters Summit in 2007. And at that time, Mike Huckabee, who's also like Robert Jeffress, the pastor who endorsed Perry, a Southern Baptist, was running against Romney. And they were, at that point in the campaign, the chief competitors with each other for the top spot there. And it was much more subtle. I mean, there were Huckabee, I think later actually made some sort of off-the-cuff comments about Mormonism, but nobody was saying Mormonism is not true Christianity. No one was saying Mormonism is a cult. I mean, definitely there was a little bit of an undertone of, you know, we're not okay with a Mormon, but it wasn't so out in the open. I think that Rick Perry has brought it out in the open.
How did you feel that played out with the crowd?
Well, I think that many evangelicals agree on some level. Maybe they don't think it's a cult, maybe they, but they would agree that it's not orthodox or true Christianity. But I also think that for a lot of people there, there's a certain level of politeness that you need to demonstrate for the candidates who come and speak there. Notwithstanding that, in the straw poll that they conduct there, Mitt Romney only got 4% of the vote, but Rick Perry only got 8% of the vote. So I don't know if it benefited either of them or harmed either of them. I think that the crowd has other issues with Romney apart from his Mormonism.
Well, you know, I find it interesting also, and I know you know this, that immediately after the summit, Family Research Council's Tony Perkins was on Fox News accusing Ron Paul, who won the Value Voters Summit straw poll, of stuffing the ballot box by bringing supporters in numbers that other candidates typically don't attempt.
I don't think that Ron Paul is really a favorite of the values voters crowd. I do think that there is resentment, not just in the leadership, but in the participants themselves, that at the last minute, Paul bussed in all these extra people. They paid their $50 if they were college students or $100 if they were not to get in and listen to Ron Paul's speech, vote in the straw poll, and then leave. I don't often defend Tony Perkins, but if you've organized a conference with the idea of galvanizing people around all these different ideas that you're disseminating at the conference and somebody just brings in people to stuff the straw poll box, you could understand the irritation.
Do serious-minded Republicans look carefully at what happens there? Or is there likely to come from this anything trend-wise that we'll see in the rest of the campaign?
It's not so much that the Republican establishment is looking at the results of the straw poll to decide where the race is going. But the truth of the matter is that what the evangelical and conservative Christian base thinks does matter for the outcome of the election. Now, I don't think that the straw poll was indicative of how voters are going to vote in Iowa or South Carolina or other states that have a heavy evangelical base. So the straw poll, I don't think, was indicative of much, if anything. But I do think that the internal war was indicative of this. Romney is the establishment candidate and Perry is the renegade who's going to bring the incendiary demagoguery to the to the conference. And I think that is a theme that's going to continue throughout the campaign.
Okay, you've told us what you saw and heard. Was there anything you didn't see in here that surprised you?
You know, there was, of course, a lot of talk about the need to unseat Barack Obama as president. That was a prevailing theme, which is not surprising. But there was very little discussion of Obama's heresy, shall you say, often at these events, you hear people talking about Obama's not really a Christian, or he might be a Muslim, or he's not a real American. Or, you know, there wasn't so much of that. I think the energy, like I said again, was focused internally on this battle over who's the genuine Christian. And it wasn't a question of is Obama a genuine Christian. It was really a question of is our front runner a genuine Christian.
Sarah, before we move away from presidential politics entirely, I want to play a clip from Tuesday's Republican debate because I want to hear your reaction to it. This is Michelle Bachmann commenting on Herman Cain's 999 tax plan.
And one thing I would say is when you take the 999 plan and you turn it upside down, I think the devil's in the details.
Your thoughts?
Well, if you were watching when she said this, she was clearly trying to make light of it. And I think it was a way of deflecting criticism of her ultra-conservative Christian beliefs that have been the subject of mockery, that have been the subject of scrutiny. And so I think she was trying to make this 666 devil joke in a way that would make light of that while also making a more or attempting to make a more substantive point that her opponent's tax plan was not perhaps all that it was made out to be.
So you got to be smarter than I thought she was in order to do that, right?
I don't think she's not smart. Okay. I think she's smart. I think she's run a terrible campaign.
Okay.
Yeah, a not smart campaign.
Okay. You've also written in Religion Dispatches magazine about the growing protest movement in the United States, variously calling itself Occupy whatever, the other 99%, most recently Occupy USA. Sarah, a week or so ago in your writing, you ask where religious leaders are in regards to this movement. And I'm wondering today, are you any closer to having an answer to that question?
Well, there are clearly religious leaders, you know, folks who are ministers or just involved in religious advocacy who are showing up in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
At the Occupy D.C. This is definitely also true in New York at the Occupy Wall Street. There's been a lot of – there's a group called Protest Chaplains who have a tent set up where they minister to people. There was a group organized by Judson Memorial Church that marched with the protesters mm-hmm. on October 6th. So – there's definitely a religious sentiment. There is the presence of religious leaders. I think partially because of the structure of this movement, this idea that there should be no hierarchy and everything governed by consensus, it sort of implicitly rejects the idea of a single or even a few charismatic religious leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the role of religion in the movement is something that still is taking shape.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at a grassroots level, there are definitely people who are either there for spiritual reasons or have spiritual needs while they're protesting mm-hmm. or camping out at, you know, in McPherson Square here in D.C. or in the park in New York. So it's something that I think is going to be really interesting to watch, but it's difficult to draw any conclusions mm-hmm. about it at the moment.
Do you see any or enough diversity to label this a bipartisan movement?
It appears that you could characterize most of the people involved in this as left-leaning,
mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't characterize them as Democrats, even though there's evidence that some of them may have been enthusiastic Obama supporters in 2008 and are disappointed now.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't call it bipartisan. I would probably call it not partisan in the sense that it's connected to a party.
Mm-hmm. Does this movement have energy enough to sustain itself and have an impact on the election?
I don't know. I mean, I think that, again, is something that remains to be seen. It's pretty remarkable that you have these movements cropping up in cities all around the country. You have it in big cities like New York and D.C. and San Francisco and Boston, but you also have it in smaller cities. Even Salt Lake City has a Occupy movement
mm-hmm.
In a very conservative state.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there is a lot of energy, undoubtedly. Can it be harnessed in a direction that it can have an impact? I think it's already having an impact in terms of the way people are thinking about these issues, but whether it could have an impact on one election cycle, it's hard to say.
Yeah. Time has flown by, as it always does when we're talking, and I hate that we're out of time, but I've got to ask you one more question. I always want to know what you're working on so that we'll know kind of what to look forward to in the days ahead.
Well, speaking of the Occupy Wall Street and spirituality and faith, we're putting together a roundtable at RD of folks talking about the role of spirituality and faith and religion and political organizing in the Occupy movement. And so that is not just – I'm the moderator. So, but it's something that we're working on, and I think it'll be probably pretty interesting to your listeners.
I bet it will. Sarah Posner is senior editor at Religion Dispatches magazine. She's a compelling writer and a delightful person with whom to talk. Sarah's the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Thanks, Sarah, for being here.
Thanks, Welton.
Coming up right after this break, I've got some thoughts on the U.S. International Religious Freedom Commission that I want to share with you. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Ray Kirstein, producer of State of Belief Radio. It's time for your host, Welton Gaddy, to once again take the guest chair as we spend a few minutes looking at recent news regarding the International Religious Freedom Commission. So, Welton, a lot of Americans may not have even known about the existence of the International Religious Freedom Commission had there not been news recently about it potentially shutting down due to lack of funding. After a last-minute extension a few weeks ago, Congress has to act again before mid-November, and a senator has placed a secret hold on the reauthorization process. What are your thoughts about this?
It is problematic for the organization that you describe it accurately as an organization within the State Department that little or few people know about. If it were doing what I wanted it to be doing, it would be very well known. Part of the problem with that committee is that one of the major responsibilities it has is every year to publish a list of the major violators of religious freedom across the world. However, that list goes from the committee's office to another office in the State Department that edits the list, and if there is a country on the list as a violator with which we want to have close political ties, or if there are problems going to be created by that country being on the list, they just take the country off the list. So it has never been a committee or a report that is authoritative regarding the status of religious freedom in the world, because it is far too politicized. And I should be very careful to say it has been politicized in a bipartisan manner. Both Democrats and Republicans have done it.
Well, especially in the face of that kind of double mandate, in the past few months, there have been news stories out of different parts of the world that particularly underscore the need for a functional, objective, empowered body to address religious freedom and the risks to individuals trying to express that. What would it take for the IRFC as it currently exists to be up to that task?
I think it would have to know the dynamics of violations of religious freedom as they are on the ground in those countries where it is violated. I know from experience on this show, as well as other experiences when we've talked with people from that office, that sometimes they are getting only cleaned up information about what's happening with religious freedom. I remember very well an interview I did with the then head of the committee regarding Cuba. And maybe it's because I've been in and out of Cuba three or four times because of our church's relationship with it. But I knew more about what was going on in Cuba than she did. And that's not good. What's clear, Ray, is that religious freedom is in trouble everywhere in the world. I can't say that forcefully enough or persuasively enough. We're seeing it develop right before our eyes. And we do need to have a presence affirming religious freedom, defending religious freedom, promoting religious freedom among our neighbors. My greatest fear is that we are not as loud and bold as we should be because we may not be as committed to religious freedom as we once were.
You know, the relevance of this is something Suhak Shukla talked about on this show last week.
Absolutely.
About how inseparable issues of religious freedom and political agendas are around the world. And then you have someone like Herman Cain last week saying he doesn't know the president of Uzbekistan because that's not at the forefront of his agenda. And to have someone proudly declaim that this is not important enough underscores just how far either the IRFC or an agency doing that kind of work has to go.
Absolutely, because unfortunately, we still have a lot of people in government as well as in the streets who think we live isolated from the rest of the world. I would hope that people in the United States would see within our own country the shifting figures related to majority-minority status. We are not the majority everywhere, and there are minorities everywhere that are under persecution.
It's not an optimistic picture of this particular story. There is funding obstacles to an organization that's working on crucial issues while having its input data laundered and its output reports filtered.
You're exactly right.
Well, we'll keep an eye on the IRFC, and thank you, Welton. I appreciate the opportunity to interview you on the first anniversary of our working together here at State of Belief Radio, and I'll turn the host microphone back to you now.
Thank you, Ray, very much. This program is good because of you in large part. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, listen to show archives, as well as to extended interviews, read transcripts, sign up for our podcast. Tell us what you like about the program. Tell us what you think we could do better. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including our listener line, 202-238-3291. I hope you'll tell a friend about our show. What we've talked about today on this show deserves conversations in your living room, around the kitchen table, at the coffee shop. I hope we'll be a part of the talk that goes on in your life in other days as well. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Find out more information about the work of the Alliance, both in Washington and in chapters across the country, at interfaithalliance.org. This work is important, really important, all over the world, and it deserves your support. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, politics, and the people who are standing in that intersection. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.